My name is Reverend Allison Lane Olson. This is August 10th at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. This is the second lecture of the day, and this is about mothers in the Bible, and specifically we'll be looking at Sarah, who we find in Genesis. Well, we are turning our thoughts to the character of Sarah. She is historically true character. She lived, Swedenborg said, many, many, many years ago. And so our question for ourselves today is, who was Sarah? And what can we learn from her experience? What can we know about her? What was she like? And then specifically looking at her journey with motherhood, what can that teach us about our lives? And that it doesn't matter whether we're male or female or how old we are, what we hope to see is that Sarah's story really is extremely relevant for our lives, all of us, in our inner life. So we actually meet Sarah, and actually as Sarai or Sarah, or how did you say her name?
Sarai,
I'll just say it that way. We meet her in Genesis chapter 11, verse 29 is when we first meet her. And she is announced to us, shared that she is Abram's wife, and that she comes from the city of Ur. And just to know a little bit about that city, something I really hadn't thought about too much before. This is just a description I found online about this, but the Sumerian city of Ur was a kind of cosmopolitan oasis in the midst of a chaotic and dangerous desert region. And it experienced its peak as a city from approximately the year 2700 to the 4th century BCE. And they excavated that place in the 1920s and 30s, and they found that the city had ziggurats. It had an entire temple area, residential and commercial sections. The religion of that time and place was polytheistic, so they believed in many gods. There was a royal cemetery they found, which was it contained treasures of gold and silver and bronze and precious stones. And there were also thousands of tablets with writings that showed that they were largely educated. Now, she is living there at the time when this city is in its height. And I was just imagining, what would it be like to go from that life, this bustling city, prospering, it's vibrant, and then to head out into the desert. And basically, she becomes this kind of nomadic tent dweller. And she would have had to have left behind her family. All that she knew was familiar. And she goes with Abram. And interestingly, just to add to that, just a little layer, her Sarai literally means my princess. Now, as a mother, of course, what comes to my mind is all the Disney princesses. And, you know, like that, like, she's a princess. But I'm thinking, you know, was this part of her kind of identity in some way? That and she's, in a sense, she's leaving that, at least what was familiar to her in her home life as she goes forward from that place. Now, we don't know what she thinks about this. You know, we're not given really any idea about her feelings about this, if this was a challenge for her, if she welcomed this challenge. We don't know anything about that part of her life. The one thing we do know that was absolutely had to be a challenge for her was the fact that she was barren and that she didn't have any children. And that's actually one of the first things we learn about her. So we first hear that she's Abram's wife in Genesis 11, verse 29, and the very next verse, verse 30, it says this: Sarai was barren, she had no child. She was barren, she had no child. And it feels like to emphasize that, to say it twice, even if a little bit differently, it's like this is significant. And this is emphasized because this is such a meaningful and part of her experience. This is part of what defines her. And something that I was reading, and I can only assume is true, is that this would have been such an awful thing to experience, and I'm sure we can relate that to anyone in our lives, ourselves or anyone we know have ever had trouble bringing children into the world or having a family, that the feelings that come with this. But on top of that, for a Jewish woman at the time, and especially for the wife of someone who was a tribal leader, to be barren would have brought on a lot of anguish and shame and despair for her. And there would have been a belief that this was a sign that there was something in her life that was causing God not to bless her. So this outside idea that she brought this on herself, and there's something about her, and this is why she can't have children. And in fact, I was thinking about the book of Job and how one of the beautiful things about that book, and it's believed to have been written during the time of the patriarchs, is when Job is sitting there, he's experiencing all of this loss, and his friends come to him and they say, "Well, what have you done?" And it's that reminder that there is this common assumption that somehow he deserved that. Like, what have you done? You need to name it so that we can, you know, rectify this and go on and move on. And he's like, "I didn't do anything." And we wish that lesson would penetrate a little more, that this isn't what this has to be about. So she has that, this anguish and this shame and this despair. Now, what we know about Sarah is that her story contains really seven episodes in the Bible, and I'd like to just relate and have us remember a little bit about her story. It starts with identifying her as barren. The other thing we also learn about her is that she is beautiful, and this is going to lead to a couple of interesting episodes in her life, which, again, we don't know how she felt about this, but pretty soon, and as Guard Perry mentioned in his lecture, they're traveling, they're going to Canaan, there's a famine, they're going to Egypt, and the idea is, and we don't know how they quite came to agree on it exactly, but because Sarai is beautiful, Abram thinks he needs to protect himself. They're going to kill him. If they see how beautiful she is, they're going to take her and kill him, and he has a much better chance, he believes, of surviving if he pretends to be her brother. So they do this. And this happens twice in her life, actually. Once here and once when she's 90. So maybe that gives us hope that our husbands will think we're so beautiful when we're 90 that they're, I don't know. So this happens twice in her life. This is part of her experience. The second time Sarah comes up is in Genesis 16, where she's really, again, a strong part of the focus of this story. And this is after many years of being in marriage with Abram, she is still childless. And again, she's probably still feeling all of those emotions, and she comes up with a plan. And this is where she decides to offer her servant, Hagar, to Abram to conceive a child. And this is an ancient legal form of surrogate motherhood that was practiced at the time. And the way that it kind of worked was that children born in this way were counted as the offspring not only of the husband who fathered them, but of the wife who owned the slave. So she says, "I can build myself up through this. Here is Hagar." And what I read is also that the slave in question would have been okay to comply because it meant their status would have been raised. And, I mean, it doesn't sound like anything that sounds good to us in this time period, but it would have been a step up for someone and their status, and also that they would have had the opportunity to then look after and raise the child. So that's part of that, but things go wrong right away. At first, it seems the plan is successful. She becomes pregnant, and that's what Sarah wants. But then it says Hagar is rude, and she's disdainful to her mistress, and Sarah resents what she sees. And this is when Hagar runs into the desert after being mistreated, and the angels come and say, "You should go back and submit." But Sarai, the some bitterness comes out in her conversation with Abram, and she said, "May the violence done to me be on you. I gave my slave girl to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became contemptible in her eyes. May the Lord judge between you and me." And so there's a lot happening in the story. The next time we read about Sarai, this is when the promise comes that she is not too old and that God has not forgotten her. She will have a child. She will be a mother of nations. This is when her name is changed and the H is added and she becomes Sarah. And then the next time, Genesis 18, the three visitors come, and of course Sarah is listening at the tent and hears the fact that she is going to become a mother, and she's 90 years old, and she's just thinks this is incredible. And following this is again the time when they're traveling. Abraham wants her to act as a sister to him again. They're going through all of these ups and downs. And then finally, in Genesis 21, we have the birth of Isaac. And also this incident. So think about, you just try to put yourself in her place. It's been 90 years. She finally has this child she has wanted for so long. And he's becoming a little boy. They're weaning him. They're having this party. Everything is good. And then there's this moment where something has happened between Ishmael and Isaac, and Sarah sees this. Now, this is like the mother bear part coming out, right? And she is not going to stand for this. The word in the original Hebrew is shq, and it can mean to play or to laugh or to sport, and a lot of versions will have to mock. Nobody's quite sure what this moment consisted of, but there is something here in which she sees Ishmael somehow mocking, or somehow we could use the language of bullying. I'm not really sure what it is, but it's enough that Sarah finally says she has to go. She has to leave. And the end of Sarah's story is she dies at the age of 127, and she's buried in a cave. What's missing is that we never hear a response. We never hear what her thoughts were when Abraham took Isaac to sacrifice him. That's a piece we never hear. I can only imagine the conversation at their house. "You did what? Where were you? What is going on?" After all those years, I can't imagine. Okay. So what I wanted to share is how can we relate to Sarah, and how is she meaningful and completely relevant to our lives right now? What do we do with her character, and what do we do with who she is as a mother? And again, as we know, so much of her experience is just wanting to be a mother, and she is putting into place all these actions. She's trying to get there. She brings Hagar into the pictures so that Ishmael comes along and she's a part of this. So the first thing I wanted to share is how Emanuel Swedenborg looks at Sarah, and as we're looking at it, not just as a historical story, but as a deeper story about our spiritual lives and ultimately about the life of the Lord. And what he says is that this is about the childhood of the Lord, and the Lord is beginning to understand that he's perceiving this divinity within when the angels come. So one of the things that Swedenborg says about Sarah is that she is truth. She is truth, and that's why she's beautiful, because truth is beautiful. And she's a spiritual or heavenly kind of truth. But the thing is that so much about her is her relationship with Abraham. And so Abraham is like the love aspect. So it is truth connected with goodness, or truth connected with love. And that's why they can't go very long in those stories where that relationship changes and they pretend for a while that she's a sister, because that's what truth is. It has to be wedded to good. And there's this beautiful lessons written as Swedenborg is writing about how much we love truth and how much we love to learn, but it is nothing if it can't lead to goodness. And if it can't be connected to that goodness, then it isn't useful. It won't be working for us. That truth is like a vessel. And in fact, what is really beautiful, I found, is that as he's writing about the Lord's experience of this, when the Lord is in his childhood, and he is growing, and this is why he has to go down to Egypt, is because he needs more. It's like whenever we need more knowledge, we need more wisdom. We're searching for that in our life. And the Lord also experienced a love for learning and loved to learn. And there was this moment when he realizes this is all for nothing if it is not connected to goodness, if it is not for, you know, becoming that vessel for welcoming love in our life. And so that grief, that if it's not for goodness, then it will be lost, is like in Pharaoh's words when he says, "What have you done to me?" And the emotion behind Pharaoh's words, he said, is like that little bit of grief that the Lord was feeling, like, I'm going to lose it if I don't use it, you know. Okay, so I thought what would be helpful is to understand where Sarah is and what she's trying to nurture and parent and bring about in our spiritual lives. I thought we might review for a moment the way that Swedenborg sees our progression of our mind, for instance. And so what we'll, I hope this diagram works. What he writes about is that when we are born, we have and we're given a soul. This soul is we all have this. It's the inmost, it's the part of us that's closest connected to God. And that life of God is flowing into our soul. And we will never be aware of it. It is so deep that we will never be aware of it. And even the highest angels, the most celestial angels, are never aware of the presence of their soul. That Lord's love flowing in, we are not aware of that. And it's protected. And that's a good thing, because it also means that we'll never do it harm. Now, we are also born with a body, but this is not us. This is just a way of carrying us around through the world. And so largely what our experience is in this world and what we're aware of is what's going on in our mind. And as Swedenborg puts it, as we're developing, what we have is an internal mind and an external mind. And again, the internal is really part of heaven. It's the goods and the truths that we learn, and that here in this part of ourself is a love of God and a love of neighbor. And in a way, this is also stored up and saved for us. And so what we want to do is get to this in our life as an awareness of that and living consciously with these loves. But a lot of that is also going to be out of our awareness. So where we're really starting as we're growing through life is here. And in a way, it feels like we're trying to get to here. And everybody, in our life, we develop by first using, he calls this the sensory level. And this really is just the senses. And we see this with babies. This is how they learn, through the senses. And then as we get a little older, we start making sense of those things. He calls this the middle level of the natural mind. Let me see, I want to write that out. We'll call it the middle natural. And again, this is just to kind of give us an idea what we're working with. So this is just how things work, and we start to bring all these facts together, and we start to make generalizations, and we start to make ideas in our minds about how things work, and it can get very complicated. And I mean, this can include economics, it can include mathematics as we're older, the humanities, psychology, why people do what they do. I think we're here a lot, just in our consciousness. But the limit to this, and the reason why we want to keep moving up the ladder, is because all of these thoughts, the limit is that it is only about the things that happen in this world. It's only about the things that happen in this world. And as spiritual beings, as this process where we are trying to regenerate and grow, we want to start thinking more about the life hereafter. And this is, so this is what Sarah, as I see it, this is what Sarah is trying to nurture in us and grow and develop and bring about, is the rational mind. And we don't, this doesn't come about overnight. We wish it did, don't we? So we're thinking about, we're trying to think about not just the things of this world, but the things of the next world. And if I asked you, think about in your day-to-day living, what is it that you are doing that is helping you to prepare for a heavenly life? If you give that some thought, what am I doing in the day-to-day life that is helping me prepare? That is us trying to use our rational, trying to think, okay, now what is just worldly, or what seems like it will be carried on, what can help me? As I'm trying to sift through what my day looks like, that's the rational trying to work. Like, because this, what I love, right, and I know we've heard this before, like that first part, ratio. It's like you're trying to see in ratio what's earthly, what's worldly, what's spiritual, what's heavenly, what's, you know, what is this in my life? How do I look towards heaven and bring that into my life? And we don't do that perfectly at first. And Sarah, she's bringing this truth. Like, there's a bigger picture here. There's another way to see life instead of just in the here and now. And that first attempt, that first trying to see that is Ishmael. So this is Ishmael's life, this first attempt at the rational. Ishmael. And so he's in the Message. So I was reading from the Message version today. It said that he is a bucking bronco of a man who stirs up conflict wherever he goes. So that doesn't, you know, that is not our rational at its best. That is a part of us that might like to argue. But at its best, it's also the part of us that can begin to compel ourselves to live by the spiritual principles we have. And this starts in adolescence. The rational mind starts in adolescence, the growth of it. And so I was thinking, you know, I remember a time in high school, I remember thinking, okay, I was having this disagreement with a person, and I thought, I'm just going to say I'm sorry because we're told to forgive. Like, that was just, you know, I said, forgive, I'm going to say I'm sorry, and we're going to move on. And it was just, I only lift that up because that was hopefully not the only time I tried to live by that, but because it was just like, you know, the adolescence, and you can think of one time maybe where you said, I'm going to try and do the right thing, and I'm going to try and live by this one rule that I know, you know, or God says, love your neighbor as yourself. I can try to do that in this one instance. And so we make a start, and that's Ishmael, and it isn't perfect. And the reason why we don't want to stop with Ishmael is because Ishmael is still, there's still some obscurities there and still some things about the earthly life that's confusing. And so maybe we don't have all the right principles and we're still not quite up to here. What we want to do is reach here so that this love of God and love of neighbor can flow down and into the rest of our life. So Ishmael is absolutely necessary, and we have to kind of keep compelling ourselves to get to the Isaac stage. But I wanted to share with you Some examples of, these are Swedenborg's examples of when we are, when Ishmael is still sort of reigning as our rational. And the reason why we have to continue to work on, so he says, so he gives the examples, which is nice. Okay. He says, so this is part of it that we're not always able to see the bigger picture, and that's the struggle. We're trying to see the bigger picture, but we can't always. So for instance, he says, the rational, here's Ishmael, supposes from appearances that the good that he does is from himself, the good that we do. It's like we know the Lord, you know, the Lord is author of all goodness and truth, but there's this part of me that really feels like it's just me working. That's Ishmael still in charge. So when we say, I kind of feel like that's me. Or we just forget about the Lord entirely and we just think, I'm doing good things. But it's not real. It still needs a little work there. Here's another example. He says, from appearances, we suppose that there can be no glory without glory of the world. So this part of us that's trying to see past this world is still connected enough with this world to see it in such a way that reputation matters, or maybe we put that higher than we should. So there's a love of the world that's still operating that isn't helping us yet. Here's another example. From appearances, we suppose that no one can love his neighbor more than himself. So that I think we can see that. Now this is the final example I wanted to mention. He says, no one can, from appearances, when we're still in this first rational, apprehend that spirits and angels who are invisible before our eyes can be seen, nor that they can speak with us, when yet they appear to the internal sight, they appear to our spirit more manifestly, more real than like Susanna sitting right in front of me. That in my spirit, the voices of angels and spirits are more real than the appearance of Tom and Susanna and all of you before me, or if I hear your voice. Isn't that a little bit like an amazing thought to try to wrap your mind around? And this is why Sarah matters, because she's trying to help us. And I like the way Gard said it, right? Share reality in a loving way. The reality is that the picture is so much bigger than what we see in front of us. And the truth, one of the truths here is that it is true that the angels and spirits speak to us and they affect us. And I think this is one of the reasons I so appreciated Curtis's lecture the other day, is because he was asking, well, what's from heaven and what's from hell in my life? If I'm experiencing fear and anxiety, guilt, shame, all of these things, is that really what heaven wants for me? And if it's not, then those things are coming from a hellish source. And can I differentiate that in my life? And what I love here is that Sarah ultimately is truth connected to good. So it's not just knowing this that's important. It's the good that can come from this. And this gives us room, right? This gives us room. If we know there are angels and spirits affecting us, then that can give me a little breathing room to try to figure out what's real here. And what's important, and actually what should I focus on, and what can I ask for help with? And her adding that H is a breathing letter. And there was a symbolism there that it was a symbol of breathing in the spiritual and letting it out. And looking to the spiritual for inspiration and letting it out. And it's like she's trying to provide us some breathing room. And trying to encourage us and nurture us to keep looking for the bigger picture and not to get stuck in the here and now. And so ultimately, that's what happens, is that Isaac will be born if we can keep working at it, if we can keep working at seeing that I don't want to just trust my own understanding. Trust not in thine own understanding, but lean on God's wisdom. If I can approach the word that way, and if I can try to do things for the right reasons and, you know, welcoming God into my life, this is what it's about, and that we can begin to regenerate this rational, of course, with God doing the work, right? And what happens is that it creates an opening when we do that, and that's when those higher loves can finally flow through and direct all of our thoughts and our affections. And I'll just add, and I'll turn the floor over here in a moment. I'll just add that so I was just appreciating Sarah and what she can teach us, and that she is trying to nurture and protect this ability of ours to look forward and to be aware of heaven. And ultimately, Ishmael had to go. On the surface of the story, there's a harshness there, but the spiritual side of the story is we don't want those doubts anymore. And if we can work on that, that's important to let that go. We want to let go of feeling like we're in charge. We want to let go of feeling like, you know, we're author of the good in our life. That's why Ishmael has to go. And this idea that we're trying to grow and change is not only for us as individuals, but also for our churches. And so that's another way of sort of contemplating the story is where are we at in our churches' lives? So I will, I guess I'd like to turn the floor over to you.
This is Julie Connor and the extroverts always first. Thank you for that. You've made that story come alive, Alison. It's like you can read it and get all this signifies this and this signifies that. But to bring it alive, to bring it in, what does this mean in our lives? Where is Sarah? That's amazing. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
Susanna Curry, when Ishmael is kicked out, the rational mind needs to not be in charge. I'm reminded that Isaac's name comes from that sense of laughter that they had when Sarah was told she was going to have a child. Does that then provide the bridge between the external and the internal? Is that, would Isaac be where that love of God and love of neighbor comes in?
Mm-hmm.
Is the, because Isaac comes into the world.
Right, he comes into the world, and that's Sarah's true son. And, yeah, he represents that rational mind that is regenerated. And his name is Laughter, and it's interesting because laughter, it comes in the story, it's there in a negative way and it's there in a positive way. And the negative way is it feels like she's almost in disbelief, like this is going to happen. And she's actually called on it. Are you laughing? Yeah, no, she says, but, you know, trying to hide that. But at the same time, in the writings, because everything has a negative and a positive, and the positive is that it's actually an affection for truth and that it's a good thing. But we always have to, like, laughter in our life, it's something to try to understand what is the motivation for it. But yes, he is, as he grows, he becomes that bridge that finally connects that.
Thank you.
Dave Keating, I was wondering if you could lay on to that where the three R's come in, repent, reform, and regenerate. And also at some point we have to decide that we're not going to be in charge anymore, but we want to do God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it possible for God to, for so many good things to happen and to really regenerate. You probably mentioned that the Ishmael is in charge, but then
Well, he, if my memory serves me correct, Swedenborg writes that that process actually starts once really with Isaac, that we have to be working towards Isaac for that to begin the regeneration process, because there's a kind of humility that has to happen. And that humility isn't always there, isn't with Ishmael. And so that's where it starts, if that makes sense. Yeah, but there's, okay, I took Sarah because I thought, all right, I have enough material. I'll be able to find lots of good material in Swedenborg. And then I found, I'm like, I've got volume 2, I've got volume 3, I've got volume 4. There's a lot to learn about in Sarah's story. And so, but if my memory serves me right, the writings do say that that process actually begins as Isaac is growing. Yeah.
Ken Wiffenden. It just struck me as interesting that his name means laughter, because laughter, like a natural laugh, is always a truth. You can't, I mean, you can fake laugh, but if you're really laughing, it's a truth, whether it's a, you know, negative laughter, positive laughter. Mm-hmm. So that's coming from God, apparently, or some
a recognition
else.
Of something
right,
that is true.
It's coming from outside us, through us.
Mm-hmm.
Your laughter is. So it just struck me as, you know, mm-hmm. interesting that Isaac means laughter.
Yeah.
Dave, we always hear that God has a sense of humor, so I'm sure he enjoys laughter. She enjoys laughter. Both.
<Nice. laughs> Very diplomatic. Well, I don't know, seeing no more questions or comments. I know it's early, but do we call it? Is that good? All right. Well, thank you very much.